Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. Soylent Green is really just a trisket, not a people biscuit.
You want answers? I want the truth. You can't handle the truth. According to the American Film Institute's top 100 movie quotes of all time, that line comes in at number 29, right before Greta Garbo's "I Want to Be Alone," and right after Ingrid Bergman's "Play It, Sam. Play as Time Goes By." Well, welcome to I Was There Too. This is the show where I talk to people present in the great scenes of cinema history. My name is Matt Gourley. And that same line also comes in at number one on the 100 most unintelligible lines from a podcast theme song. Which podcast? Ha, this one. That's right. I get more email about what lyric comes after the words "it's been said" in the I Was There Too theme song. Well, it's "You Can't Handle the Truth." The line from today's film, A Few Good Men, written by Aaron Sorkin, directed by Rob Reiner, and today's guest from that film is the great Josh Malina. You may also know him and love him from In the Line of Fire, Sports Night, The West Wing, Larry Sanders Show, and Scandal. Now let's connect him to last episode's guest. Here we go. Adam Bush to Danny Aiello in The Professional to Danny Aiello and Bruce Willis in Hudson Hawk, a movie which, just between you and me, I kind of liked. Bruce Willis, well, hell, he was married to Demi Moore to Josh Malina in A Few Good Men. Well, that's not how this game is played. You can't use marriages. Well, my podcast, my rules. Now let's get to this interview, because it was a fun one. And Josh was a pleasure to have in my microphone. Come out of the microphone, Josh. It's time to start the interview. Here we go.
The film, A Few Good Men. The year, 1992. The role, Tom. The actor, Joshua Malina.
Well, Josh Malina, you've had already a storied career from films like A Few Good Men to In the Line of Fire to the Aaron Sorkin classics, Sports Night, The West Wing to Scandal. But I want to start with what I understand to be your first job in the industry, and that was as production assistant on the film Fletch Lives.
That is true, yeah.
How did that happen?
Let's see. My dad was partners with a guy named Bruce Bodner, great guy, who worked with Chevy Chase and told me that he could arrange for me to get a job on the film. And I had the, attitude of, I knew I wanted to be an actor.
Yeah.
But I don't even know how a film set works. Let's do that.
Did you have much interaction with Chevy Chase?
Yes. Chevy couldn't have been nicer. Very nice guy. I also, to date, wrote my only word to make it into a movie. As a PA. I can't remember where we were. I'm sure I was, by the coffee machine, which is largely what I did. A lot of copies and made a lot of coffee. And, I think running joke in the Fletch movies is that his middle name starts with M.
Uh-huh.
And he always gives various pseudonyms for what the M
or an
M Fletcher. Right. So he's walking by and Chevy goes, Josh, tell me a funny M name that's not Malina. And so I said, Mahatma. He said, I'm going to use it.
And it
made it into the movie.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Very
I love
exciting.
Uncovering little gems like this is what this show is all
and
about.
And then I instantly retired as a film writer.
were you just a production assistant or were you a writer's assistant?
I was just a PA. And literally, make coffee, make copies. Eventually, my responsibilities came to involve pick up the DP and maybe somebody else. Because I remember a lot of very, very early morning. I had a car. My folks had given me, I think, the old Chevy Caprice. Uh-huh. I would go and I'd have to, at like 4:15 in the morning, go pick up the DP and drive him to the set in Queens, Kaufman Astoria Studios. And I remember at the time I was still getting over a heartbreak. So I'd get up an extra half hour early. I'd sit on the hood of my car and
just
cry.
Seriously?
Yeah. Maybe that was as I was waiting. I'd get there. I'd park and wait for the guy to come down. But I'd get there really early. Yeah.
Hold on. Before we
I'm trying to paint the most pathetic picture I possibly can.
Did you schedule that half hour or you just couldn't sleep? Or you went, I need to cry.
I didn't want to appear to have just cried when I saw the guy.
Oh my
so I'd
God.
Get there even a little earlier so I could cry, dry my tears, air dry my tears, and then pick up the guy.
I don't even know what to say. So endearing and charming.
Probably just best to move on.
Well, it's one thing that you're getting over a heartbreak while you're working on Fletch Lives. It's another thing that you build that into your day to sort of give it its due. That's the smartest way I've ever heard to get over a heartbreak.
Right.
Give it, like, it's almost like work time. You need to schedule it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, you're just learning life tips on this show.
That is true.
Oh,
and then on the other end of the day, eventually my duties, or maybe from the beginning, I can't quite remember, they would take the footage that had been shot that day and give it to me. I was, you know, I don't know, 22, not super, even emotionally mature. I had cried all morning. They'd give me all the footage and I'd have to drive to Newark Airport to be sent to LA to be processed and then sent back so they could watch dailies the next day, which sounds incredibly old school, which I guess it was because it was probably 1988. And I remember thinking, I've got to be the least responsible person on this entire set. Why are they giving me the most precious cargo, which is what they shot all day? And then I drive to Newark Airport. There was no way to do it legally. I park illegally. I had just sheaves of parking tickets from those 3 months. And I'd have to do.
Maybe somebody wanted the film lost. Like they were
possibly.
Just going, this is a
might
sequel
have been
that, yeah, it might have been. So, wow, you have a charmed career. In your first job ever, you're contributing to the writing process.
It was very exciting.
Oh, my God.
I also remember eventually, you know, there's somebody has to man the bell, which is like, you know, we're rolling, and they buzz, so everyone on the stage knows. And when they finally gave me that, and I was excited to sort of get on the set and on the stage itself, they allowed me to do that, and I sort of had my head in my hand during the take.
Weeping.
And I slipped and I hit the buzzer in the middle of a take.
God.
And that is frowned upon.
Yeah.
That was really embarrassing.
Well, why were you getting all these jobs? I picture you in a suit and tie, but one of those 80s white collar shirts and like wire rim glasses. And they went, this guy looks responsible.
No, I think it was more casual than that. I don't know. It was bottom of the totem pole stuff.
Wow, still, man, you rose quickly.
Bro, yeah.
And then
you're
right into it as an actor because your first film role is A Few Good Men. Am I right about that?
That is true, yes.
Okay, so let's go back. Now, you've worked with Aaron Sorkin quite a bit. So how did you come to be associated first with the play, right?
Yes. Well, first with Aaron.
Okay.
Altogether. It started on a personal note.
Yeah, I heard a little of something about you possibly saving his life.
There's that, too.
Okay.
But even prior to that, we became buddies. I grew up in New Rochelle, New York, in the suburbs, 45 minutes north of the city. He grew up in Scarsdale, which is a few minutes away, also in Westchester. He went to high school with my dear cousins, Joel Stewart and Rachel. And I saw him in high school plays.
Oh, my God.
I saw him in Godspell.
What was he playing? Ensemble?
Judas? He played Judas or Jesus. Whichever one. He was.
You know,
great.
They're the same, essentially.
Yeah, essentially, two sides of the same coin. So I knew him a little bit when I graduated from college, knowing that I wanted to be an actor from a very young age. My mother, as Jewish mothers do, suggested I call Aaron, I think largely because he's also Jewish. I remember thinking, you think this is going to work? I'm just going to cold call Jews until I'm an actor. But for lack of a better plan, I actually did call Aaron. And, you know, he was a poker player. He used to host poker games. And so we became friends over these weekly, sometimes twice weekly poker games.
Because you're an avid poker player, right?
In fact, you had
a show, the Poker Showdown.
That's true. Celebrity Poker Showdown. Yes. Yeah. So we became friends across the poker table. I knew him as an actor. Somewhere in this poker phase, he explained to me that he had been writing and that he had written this play, A Few Good Men, and did I want to audition? And I was desperate to try to find – I was like, of course I do. And then I'm sure largely due to his urging, I was actually cast in the play. And I had grown up dreaming of being on Broadway.
Yeah, of course.
That was an utter dream come true.
And were you playing the same role, Tom?
Originally, there were five of us who played very small roles – and understudied the leads, and I understudied three of the main parts. We all had little bits to do, little bits of, you know, I probably had six lines of dialogue throughout the play. Act two was largely standing at parade rest in the courtroom, which was physically harrowing. And we would move little furniture around, and
theater scene change.
Yeah, exactly.
The fluid theater scene change. Before we even move on, if you're interested in Aaron Sorkin as an actor, he's in A Few Good Men at the bar talking to a woman when they pan across.
Good catch.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about your role specifically in the film. So
First
of all, how long were you doing the play?
I did the play the entire Broadway run, which was about 15 months.
Uh-huh.
It was a dream come true. The last 6 months, I played PFC Downey. One of the two defendants.
The
white guy.
The slower one.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I sort of had a choice where I could, after the first 6 months of the run and people left, they said, do you want to – I had been understudying Sam Weinberg, the Kevin Pollak role in the movie,
uh-huh.
Mark Nelson on Broadway, Corporal Howard, who was Jeffrey Knopf's on Broadway, and Noah Wiley in the movie,
uh-huh.
and PFC Downey. Michael Dolan in the play, and James Marshall. James Marshall. I wanted to say James Marshall. I wish I had. So they basically said, do you want to play Corporal Howard or PFC Downey? And I felt like Corporal Howard had like one funny comic great scene where everybody claps when you leave. But I was amazed they were offering me, do you want to play this sort of corn-fed Iowa
That seems like the meatier
dullard.
Role.
yeah, exactly. Also, it was like I always thought of myself as a comic actor, so I couldn't even believe they were offering me. I'm like, oh, I'll do that one. Not really thinking through the fact that I could either do the role who is on stage for the entire play, much of it being on trial for murder and not saying anything about it, or being the guy who has one really funny role and leaves and hangs out backstage.
You could be drinking, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So in the tour, I would ultimately play Howard. So I played PFC Downey. Got the opportunity to audition for that role in the movie because Rob Reiner, I think from the beginning, wanted to make it into a movie. Aaron Sorkin, to his credit, part of the contract was this is a play. I want it to be a play produced on Broadway, and then we'll make the movie. And so that's how it happened. I flew out to L.A. Aaron, either screwing with me or making an honest mistake, said, "Now there's two Beverlys. There's a Beverly Drive and there's a Beverly Boulevard. So remember, Castle Rock is on Beverly Boulevard.
Oh, no.
Of course, Castle Rock is on Beverly Drive. So I'm just, and this is the day, the Thomas Guide, no GPS, nobody, Siri's not helping me find this audition. So I've flown out to LA on my own dime to audition, and I'm just driving back and forth on Beverly Boulevard. I'm like, where's Castle Rock?
This makes me cringe.
No, it's terrible.
How late were you?
I want to say 45 minutes, drenched in sweat. I remember pounding the roof of my car. I damaged it. I was like, damn it. What? I was so mad. I was like, this is my only chance. I've completely blown it.
Were you auditioning specifically for Downey or Howard?
Downey.
Okay.
Ultimately, they didn't seem to care much. They brought me in, although I was a disheveled, sweaty mess. I didn't get the part. It went to James Marshall,
uh-huh.
as previously mentioned. But they tossed me the you know, remember Aaron saying, well, we got you something, and you're going to play Tom. Tom is the guy who, you know, has five words, three of them yes, two of them sir.
We're going to talk about Tom.
We're going to get in deep.
Yeah.
You're going to be wrong.
Oh, how long after the play was the film? Did you go right into that, or did you – you toured for a while after the Broadway production.
Yeah, but that was after the film.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah.
Oh.
The film happened between – could be making that up. No, I'm not. Yeah, no, the film happened shortly after the play closed in 1990.
Okay.
think so that's when we shot.
Yeah, the film is 92.
Yes, that makes sense. We shot it in 90, 91, I guess.
You're the only actor from the play to be in the film?
That could be true.
Yeah.
That might be true.
All right. So let's talk about Tom. Okay.
Okay.
When Jack Nicholson calls you in the room, you enter so quickly that it cannot be that you're just standing by the door. You have to have your hand on the knob and your ear to the door. Like
This is probably a critique of my performance.
Or editing. It could be editing.
Yes. Actually, I learned very important I learned about editing. This was I was as green could be. And so, yeah, the situation is that Jack Nicholson calls me in. Tom, I come in. I say, sir. And he says, we're surrendering our position in Cuba. Get the president on the phone. We're surrendering our position in Cuba. And I go, yes, sir. And I start to leave. And then he stops me because he's being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. Let me give – maybe we should think this through a little bit more. And then he sends me off and I leave. So first, I guess we're doing, you know, his coverage, the more important aspects of the scene. And it was a lot of fun. J.T. Walsh and Kiefer Sutherland and Jack Nicholson. I'm watching all these great actors work, which is fascinating. And they're nice. And Nicholson – every time he walks by me, he gives me, he's like, Oh, Tom.
Does he ever call you kid?
No, he called me Tom. Right. And it was like Nicholson doing Nicholson for me. And I was like, that is spot on. But he was nice. You know, he kind of took me in. I remember everyone being sort of friendly. Then when it was time to do my single, which is essentially me at the door coming in, saying, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, leaving. Nicholson did his entire spiel off camera, which was a great lesson that I've carried.
You will do that now?
I mean, I get now that that's half your job. Half your job is doing your lines when you're not on camera. Although I've worked with people, you know, sometimes who disappear.
And you wouldn't expect that of Jack Nicholson, especially for something as
that's
small
what I
as
thought.
This.
Exactly. Yeah. I literally, my lines are yes, sir, and he has a whole spiel to do, and he is Jack Nicholson. I thought, you know, I didn't expect him to stand off camera and, like, feed me so I could do.
Yeah, it's not like you're crying in a monologue. You just have to say yes.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I was impressed by that and struck by, like, that's a professional. And then the first time I did, he goes, Tom, I poke my head in, sir, call the president, we're surrendering our position to Cuba. Yes, sir. I start to leave. Does the thing. No, wait a minute. Maybe we should reconsider it. You can get dismissed. Yes, sir. I leave. Cut. And I hear uproarious laughter. Rob Reiner and Nicholson are laughing and laughing. And then my head starts swimming. I don't know what. I said yes, sir, twice. I don't know what is going on. I will subsequently find out that they got a kick out of the fact. I didn't think I was really even acting. I don't know, I was saying yes, sir, closing it. But Nicholson said, I give him this ridiculous order. He's a Marine. He doesn't question it. He just goes there and whatever. So I'm like, wow, I'm killing it.
You are the paragon of military obedience, because not only do you accept the fact that he wants you to call the president and surrender to Cuba, but when he says it's a joke, you still just go, okay.
Right, exactly.
I mean, this guy.
Yeah. Now, I don't know that I thought deeply about the role, but maybe it was from playing a Marine for hundreds of performances on Broadway, but it just seemed to me that was the scene.
But when you hear Nicholson explain what he thinks obedience should be in the military, specifically the Marines,
right,
you could see why he's chosen this guy who is literally unflinching in his acceptance of anything.
I guess
walk
so
off that cliff, Tom.
Yeah, I'm delighted to take credit for the performance. But here's the thing. The second take, my head is now swimming with, like, I'm on fire. I'm killing it. I don't know if I'm even entirely exactly sure. But so my head is still so fulfilled with the experience that the second take, Tom, yes, sir. Call the president. We're surrendering our position in Cuba. I go, yes, sir. But I don't start to leave. And I'm like, oh, now I'm thinking, oh, I fucked up. I didn't leave. I got two things to do, say yes, sir, and start to leave. And now there's just a weird stalemate because it doesn't occur to me, green as I am, that there's editing. Just start to leave now.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we
right.
Cut around it.
Yeah.
So I just stand there like a dolt staring at him.
Waiting for cut.
And Reiner's like, cut. And, you know, it's literally like from hero to goat. He's like, yeah, Josh, so you're supposed to start to leave.
and do they're probably sitting there thinking he wants more screen time.
Yeah, maybe, exactly.
Doing?
What do you think?
He's got something planned.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so
my God.
It's years later. I blush to think of it.
But when you're doing something that's just your first film role,
sure,
and in my limited acting experience, everything, your nerves are so heightened that everything's milky and something as simple as opening a door. For some reason, coming through a door as your first thing in a scene is one of the most difficult things to do.
It was because, for me, because yeah. There's also clearly there's a place where they want you to open the
That's
door.
That's the second part.
I'm yeah. sure. I don't remember exactly, but having opened doors since, there's usually a line or a little piece of tape, open it only to hear, or they put down a sandbag so you can feel where to – there's a lot to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then also, perhaps counterintuitively, the smaller your role – I think the more difficult it is.
No kidding.
Because you just start, and I've played tiny roles where you have one line and all, you know, you think through every possible word you can emphasize, or I could say it this yeah. way and I could do that.
You're bogged down with the minutiae. Like doing a scene like that where you have to open a door and then land on a mark is to me like when you take your driver test at the DMV, you can drive normally and you're fine. But when you have something like under that much scrutiny, it becomes impossible. Yes, it's so strange.
Yes. And speaking of which, the first time I had to drive a car in film was also a nightmare. And that was In the Line of Fire.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if we're going to go there.
Oh, we'll get there. That's after the break. I've got some questions for you there, too. In fact, specifically about that. But speaking of coverage, so when you are doing some involved scene and they're doing the other person's coverage and you're off camera and you're giving them everything. Have you ever had the circumstance where you've given your best performance and you weren't even on camera?
All the time. Oh, all the time. Yeah. Yeah. I like to go, I think I prefer to go last. You know, usually the last, whoever's the, you know, the big shot in the scene, you know, do you want to go now? You want to go first? Or if it's super emotional, they'll usually want that person to go first uh-huh. so they don't have to do, you know, be super emotional off camera
right.
for 20 takes and then, you know, bring the tears on camera. So, yeah, I would say I'd rather go second because I feel like I find stuff as I'm running the scene. I'd rather be off camera running the scene and then turn around and maybe I'll know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, all the time I go, oh, now I get it. But that's like everything, you know, everything I've ever shot on the way to the car and every audition on the way to the car. I'm like, ah, now I know how yeah. to do the scene.
Yeah. Everything's a rehearsal.
Sure.
Yeah. Before we take a break, I do want to talk about this famous incident with Aaron Sorkin. And is this legendary? Is this real where you performed the Heimlich maneuver on him?
I did indeed.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Years later would receive out of the blue a certificate from Dr. Heimlich himself.
What?
Attesting that, yeah. I don't know.
He probably, just goes around delivering this?
I guess. I don't know. He probably saw it on IMDb, and I have it somewhere. Yeah, that is true. So during the Broadway run, one of the small perks of being in a Broadway show is you get to participate in the Broadway Bowling League, which is about as glamorous as it sounds. You know, one night a week, the guys from A Few Good Men bowl against the cast of A Chorus Line, and you have fun, and you see who wins, and I guess you keep track of stats. And so one of these nights, we were bowling, and Aaron, in what was a typically magnanimous gesture, bought like a huge tray of hamburgers for everyone. And then it was his turn to bowl, and he sort of, with a flourish, took an enormous bite of hamburger.
Well, as he's about to bowl, like
right before he's going to bowl,
a defiant.
I don't know what it was. But it was kind of look at this, and then he started to choke. Then he started to choke on it.
Well, that seems somewhat karmic.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But for a while, and this is very, I guess, I think Dick Shawn died this way.
Thought he was joking.
Yes. Yeah. And we were sort of laughing yeah. and looking at him, and then he hit the ground.
Oh my God!
And his eyes were bulging. We kind of looked at each other like, I think this is real. And I don't know that I'm generally good in a crisis, but I just had the impulse.
Well, you were the one, clearly, the first one.
I was the one. Although I remember my friend Pete later would say, yeah, I was about to do that.
Mm, yeah, sure.
Right, but you didn't.
Yeah, no, you didn't. Where were you, Pete?
So yeah, I kind of picked him up. I got behind him. I didn't really know what I was doing. I cracked two or three of his ribs.
This is something because you've probably seen it on TV and that sort of thing?
I think I had seen a poster in the back of a restaurant. There's like three things. Get behind them, you ball your fist, you put your hand over it. And I encourage everybody to familiarize yourself with the Heimlich maneuver.
Well, clearly you don't
sure.
need to.
And then you go from behind, you know, in and up and in and up. And my memory is I was just beating him up. I was just pounding, pounding. And I remember at the time thinking, like, he's going to die in my arms.
Oh my
God. But then this, you know, giant thing shot out of his.
And what was the aftermath?
The aftermath was almost as good. I'm not going to reveal names, but one dear friend instantly had diarrhea.
From just the nerves
from witnessing
of the
it, like, oh I got to run. Literally. And Aaron, after a lot of like huffing and puffing, like, wow, what just happened? Aaron decided to continue bowling.
Okay.
And did, is it a Fred Flintstone thing? He did the thing where he ran up and went whoop and landed on his back. Oh. He lost his feet and like fell on his back and said, I think I'm done.
Maybe that's what cracked his ribs.
Also possible.
Yeah.
All went home and that was like that, you know. Oh. And in a perhaps not unrelated note, I've gone on to appear in most things that Aaron has written since then.
Oh, right.
I don't want to say that's
no.
Why. No.
He's it's a combination of talent.
He was already a good
life-saving.
Friend of mine.
Sure.
Well, it's really more a combination of friendship and maybe a little life saving. Yeah.
Did you get any kind of glimpse at Nicholson's process? Was it pretty much just stand and deliver? Or?
It seemed like a light switch.
Really?
On and off, yeah. I didn't see any psyching himself into anything. I didn't see, after cut, much of a change of a return back to Jack. I think he's one of those guys who just completely has it. Or certainly, at least in that role, I think he so owned it that, at least when I worked with him, it was just there and it was on and off. And there was no, you know, he didn't demand anything of you. He wasn't pretending to be in character when we weren't filming. He just turned it on and off. It was like that was like a real room of. It was fun to watch those guys too. You could see the mutual respect and
sure.
Sort of old pro camaraderie of it all.
And how was Rob Reiner? He seems like he would be very, I don't know, welcoming and
couldn't have been nicer. Subsequently worked with him on The American President too. So he also was very
you save his life
good to me. No. he was very very nice, very easy, funny guy.
I love to hear that. I love to hear when there's a good environment on the set. That's great. All right, we're gonna take a break and we'll come back and talk about In the Line of Fire. All right, Clint Eastwood, Rene Russo, Josh Malina. I know. God, what's the deal with him?
I've got an anecdote about him.
Give it. Before we even get to you, just tease us with a little Malkovich.
Not that nice to me.
Really? I heard he spent a month in isolation preparing for this role. Is that even real?
That I would believe because because I found myself in an elevator with him early on. We shot downtown at the Bonaventure Hotel.
Yeah.
And so instead of a trailer, we each had a little hotel room, which was fantastic. And I found myself in the...
Was it the glass elevator you were in with him?
Perhaps it was. I believe it was.
This is great.
So that people could witness my disgrace. And I'm not the kind of like, hey, ho kind of guy, but I thought, I'm actually in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, I should be able to say,
it's
valid. I wouldn't walk up to this guy on a sidewalk. And also what I'm going to say is going to be nice. So I said, Mr. Malkovich, I'm sure I called him Mr. Malkovich. It's nice to meet you. I'm playing Agent Chavez. I saw you last summer or whatever, 3 years ago. I drove cross country with my sister. We stopped in Chicago. I had seen him in a play. I complimented his performance. They did a whole thing. Super respectful, super nice. And then he just turned to me and said, oh.
Oh.
And again, to reference Fred Flintstone, when he's really embarrassed and disgraced, he turns like 3 inches tall. I did that in the elevator, and then I just scurried out of the elevator.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Do you think that was just him, or was he in some kind of character? Were you guys heading to the shoot?
I think, in retrospect, he may have been in character always. He was one of those guys. Because then I saw him during free time making weird little sketches. And I think it was just sort of, I think Mr. Malkovich wasn't in that elevator with me.
Right. That would be in line with his character, too.
Right.
Yeah. Doesn't want to be found out. He
yeah.
Probably doesn't
there
like
you
people
go.
Identifying him.
Right. He had his weird little wooden gun in his pocket.
That's right.
And thought I might ask about it. So.
Then he'd have to kill you. You almost got killed.
That's true.
Yeah. He was going around killing everybody that asked about that. So at one point you're driving Clint Eastwood around. You're driving him to the airport, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I even go back and say how I getting the job?
Please, yes.
I auditioned, I guess, on tape for the role. And then I got the follow-up call from my agents. Wolfgang Petersen, the director, would like to meet you.
Oh.
I was like, fantastic. Oh, and also they think you're Latino. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Your name does have a Latino ring to it.
Exactly. Yeah. And the role is Agent Chavez.
But it's Polish, right, your name?
I am, in fact, Polish Jewish. Melina is the Polish word for raspberry. I'm not Latino. Nor am I comfortable lying about my ethnicity. So I said to my agents, why are you telling me that now? You could have told me beforehand, hey, we're going to submit you and lie about your ethnicity. And I would have said, oh, no, don't do that. I'm not comfortable with that. I said, I'm not going to lie. They were like, fine. I'm sure it won't come up. Then just don't bring it up. Yeah. I'm like, fine. I walk in the door. I meet Wolfgang Peterson. We sit down. He goes, yeah, so what's your ethnicity?
Oh, my God.
On top of it, with the German accents, I'm like, I'm Jewish.
Well, no, Polish, he can't refuse you.
Maybe that's why I ultimately got it, because I put him in a position. So apparently they were looking to cast somebody Latino in this Latino role, although it was just really a name.
Of course, but you're the L.A. guy, right? So you've got to be Hispanic.
Yeah, there you go, exactly.
But this is becoming a developing theme on this podcast, because Jeanette Goldstein, who plays Vasquez in Aliens, is a Jewish actor as well, and she doesn't have any Hispanic heritage in her whatsoever. So I don't know. There's something going on there.
Something weird.
So you're basically the head of the Secret Service in Los Angeles. I mean, the way they kind of have you running
Do I seem that high-ranked?
And you're just a young man.
Young buck.
Done well for yourself.
Yeah.
All around, you always have a charmed career, whether you're playing the character or it's you.
Although ultimately I am driving Clint Eastwood to the airport.
Well, you're
a hands-on leader.
Yeah, exactly. Hands-on.
I'll do it. I'm going to do this.
How was it driving Eastwood around? I somehow imagine him to be like a backseat driver or something. What was he like?
He couldn't have been nicer in the entire process. I have found people like Nicholson, like Eastwood, even in these super limited capacity roles that I'm playing around them, I find them to be very, very nice. There's a certain level at which there's nothing to prove. They don't have to, you know, there's no dick on the table kind of thing. Can you say that?
Yeah, you sure can.
You know, they're big stars already. Uh-huh. So sometimes it's like two or three levels down. That's where the real assholes, that's where they work, exactly. And they have to have something to prove, and they want to knock you down. So neither were like – Clint Eastwood, I remember talking about cat allergies with him.
Really?
Yeah, he was just like, he'd sit and he'd talk about whatever came up. And also, I definitely learned a little bit about acting on film there, because he would speak almost inaudibly. You know, and later I'd watch the performance and it was great. But at the time I was thinking, my turn to speak?
So he's just knows he's going to be ADR'd the whole time, or what?
I don't know if it's that, or, you know, those microphones will get it, but he does so little that it's almost like, are you still awake and did you say your line? And then you watch it and it's like, wow, that works. So, like, that guy's cool. You don't really have to do much on camera.
That's a good lesson.
Yeah. And so when I had to drive him, I was a little bit nervous, because I had to drive very precisely.
Yeah.
I had to hit two little sandbags they had put down.
Is this your first time driving on camera?
First time driving on camera. I have to hit the sandbags, let him out. He'll come around to the passenger side, and we'll talk about how you spell ukulele,
right,
which is basically the scene. Yeah. And so the first time we do the first take, I drive in at 0.7 miles an hour. I feel the sandbags. I stop. He gets out. We do the scene. And I hear cut. And Wolfgang Peterson runs up. He goes, it's a little wimpy. It's a little wimpy.
The driving?
Yeah. He's like, you're a Secret Service agent. You know, you're a little more ballsier. You get in there, pull in, and you do the scene. I'm like, okay. So, of course, I overcompensate. And I drive way too fast on the second take. I hit the sandbags. There's sort of, I see Clint Eastwood kind of seesawing back and forth a little bit. And he finally settles, gets out. We do the scene.
So he doesn't break. He just.
No, we do the scene. God bless him. Yeah. And
Dirty Harry, for crying out loud.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. He can take a little, a hard stop or two.
Yeah.
And I hear cut. And that, I don't think it was Wolfgang Peterson. Someone else comes over. The first AD comes over and starts really bitching me out. Like, what are you doing? This is the star of our movie. You're driving like a fucking maniac. What do you got? Clint Eastwood walks over. He goes, now, wait a minute. This would be better if I did a better Clint Eastwood.
That's not bad.
Imagine
That's
Clint
not
Eastwood.
Bad.
Wait a minute. director of this film just called this man a wimp. Of course he's going to get in there and he's going to drive. And I was like, what? Clint Eastwood saving my job, shaming the first AD.
But all in the name of masculinity.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
completely.
What you want.
Exactly. Yeah.
If, oh my God, anytime you get emasculated in life, if you had Clint Eastwood to just
step in
and defend your manhood.
Yeah, it was a little bit like the Marshall McLuhan moment. Yeah. I happen to have Clint Eastwood here. Clint, can you explain why? So that was very, very nice of him.
That's like that – I won't go through the whole thing, but that famous story that Jay Thomas would tell on Letterman every year where he gets into an accident, but he's a hippie at the time, but he's driving Clayton Moore dressed as Lone Ranger around. And the guy that hits him says – like, you hit me, and it wasn't true. And he's like, no, I didn't. And then he goes, yeah, what are you going to do about it? And the Lone Ranger gets out of the car and goes, I'll do something about it, citizen.
That's fantastic. Yeah, there you go. That's my version.
Oh, that's lovely. So you play Will Bailey on The West Wing, and you apparently were known for being quite a prankster on the set. Is that true?
That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the hours are long. Things get boring. Uh-huh. I remember usually for a while you feel like a guest and you have to wait till you're comfortable on a set before you start actually antagonizing.
Yeah. Around,
the rest of the
around
people.
What season is that for you?
That's
what
a good
year?
Question. It might've been the end of the first season for me. I remember early on, it's the things that go badly that I tend to remember. I know that when Mary McCormick joined the cast. We were working in Baltimore and D.C., and I knew that she hated bugs, and it was – I guess they have a pretty rough, like, cicada season in D.C., and it was that season, and so she was sitting on a bench somewhere, and I just took a little twig – And you lightly touch someone's ear. Because I knew she was all – you didn't – is cicada? Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I knew she was all revved up about these things. And I touched her ear with this twig, and she burst out crying. I think she was pregnant at the time too. Aww. So there was sort of a hormonal element to it all. And crying and crying and crying, which is, you know, not what I had in mind, and not what the people who wanted her to film a scene and look like she was not crying had in mind.
Oh, my God.
So I got a little blowback there.
But that, that's partially circumstances you can't control. I
mean, sure.
That reaction is a little disproportional.
That is true. Another time we were filming an episode that takes place on Air Force One, and Alice and Janney had to keep answering the phone. So I coated the phone in a proprietary mix of Vaseline and suntan lotion. I got in trouble for that.
You really got in trouble?
Yeah, because she got an earful and maybe a wigful that day. She might have been wearing something, and it was all over her. And it was like, well, now we have to shut down production for a while we clean up your joke.
Costing money
at
this point.
So, yeah, that wasn't good.
You stole Bradley Whitford's letterhead and sent Jimmy Smits some flowers, right?
That is true. Janelle Maloney and I did this. I got to cut her in. We had the idea for Valentine's Day. I think Jimmy had just joined the cast a couple, 3 weeks earlier. And I would routinely, if I could get into Brad Whitford's trailer, if it were left open and he weren't there, I would just kind of root around for what might come in handy. He also used to write very weirdly life-affirming messages on Post-its around his mirror.
Really?
And I would amend those to be less life-affirming.
Do you remember an example?
I wish I did. I remember a couple that I don't think I want to share.
No, fair enough.
But I also found some Brad Whitford stationery. Years later, Jimmy Kimmel would suggest to me that it's also easy to make up stationery with anyone's name on it. Oh. You don't have to find – you can just go to a place and say, I need some – this is what I need. And say, Bradley Whitford.
I appreciate your authenticity.
Yeah. I got the real deal.
Yeah.
And so we wrote a sort of lightly homoerotic Valentine from Brad to Jimmy Smits, and we had like 3 dozen roses delivered to Jimmy on set with a note. You know, it's only been a couple of weeks together, but boy, do I like working with you. I think this relationship, it was really finely. I wish I had, saved it or written down. And I wasn't there for it, but I understand it was incredibly awkward.
Really?
Yeah. And Jimmy Smits very quickly wanted to assert his heterosexuality. He was like, Brad, oh man, the flowers, they're nicer than what I gave my girl. I have a
whom
girl.
I make love to every night of the week, now, twice on Sundays.
Yeah, 2 days later, Brad came to me. He was like, very funny. Very funny. But Jimmy Smits never knew. I don't know. A great amount of time passed, and like 6 months later, we were yucking it up in the makeup trailer about how funny that was. And Jimmy was like, that was you? And my Jimmy Smits does sound a lot like my Clint Eastwood. I'll grant you that. Yeah, and he was mad. I was like, dude, no, I didn't know you didn't know. I thought everybody knew. So it's 6 months of like, you thought someone had made fun of him, and he wouldn't shake my hand. I was like, dude, just kidding, right? And he would not extend his hand. Ultimately, we would achieve closure when the entire cast did the Ellen show, when the show was ending, when the whole series was wrapping up. And one of the things she did was she wheeled out cakes. There was a cake for each of us with our likeness. Uh-huh. And and you can actually see this on YouTube. I saw and overheard Jimmy Smits lean over to Richard Schiff and say, I'll give you $5,000 if you smash that in Josh's face. And so I just ran off the set. It was towards the end anyway. It was clearly like we were wrapping up. So I just started running. And Mary McCormick, perhaps getting me back for the cicadas, she kind of grabbed me. They all chased me, grabbed me, and Jimmy Smits, or I guess everybody, kind of just pelted me with cake.
I'm going to look for that it's clip there, on YouTube. Yeah. We'll post it on the episode page. So your hit rate for these practical jokes, at least the ones you've described, is zero.
That's true.
In terms of them going over well.
Yeah, that's about right.
Are you still doing these to this day?
Yeah.
Good
for
you.
I've done stuff on Scandal.
Good.
Although ultimately I'm at the point where I've lost the trust of everybody on the show.
Yeah, people know you for this now?
Yes, okay. Exactly. So first of all, there's a big light on me on April Fool's Day. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is my day off.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do anything on April Fool's Day. Amateur.
Yeah.
But then I also did a whole extended thing with knowing that Jimmy Kimmel loves jokes. I sort of pitched in this idea that what if I convince everyone on the show that we're going to make a birthday video for you, but we'll pre-write the messages they're going to say so that we can edit them into saying really silly things.
And then Danny switched the wording around?
Yeah. We wrote them so that we knew we could cut them. And then Danny Ricker is the head writer.
I know Danny Ricker.
Oh, fantastic guy.
Yeah.
So on camera, I kind of took – I'm glad I can give credit here where credit is due, because Danny Ricker and the writing staff of Jimmy Kimmel brilliantly – and I helped too, but they really brilliantly came up with this stuff so that we could get them to say ridiculous things. And they were brilliantly worded. The hard sell was trying to explain to them why we're going to make a birthday video for Jimmy Kimmel in which I'm going to pre-write what you say. But amazingly, the only person who blanched at that was Kerry Washington. She was like, just conceptually, can't I just say? I was like, no.
Trust me.
You have to say this. It's going to cut together funny. And then you can actually see in her one, she was like, she's the only one who – she like made a choice. She's like, okay, well, but I'm going to do it like I'm pissed that you're making me say this. I'm like, fine. So in the ultimate thing, you can see she's doing a thing. The rest of them just cows. They're like, okay. And they're doing it and selling it and making them do multiple takes. I'm like, I know they missed an important word. I got to – and then you can see that on YouTube too. And it's Jeff Perry saying it hurts when I pee. And
we'll put both of those links up on the episode page.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. But everybody, there was some back. People weren't happy.
I don't think you've lived until you've been pranked by Josh Malina.
Yeah, right?
You're the new Clooney.
Yeah, in so many ways.
Thank you for coming on. I was there too. You're on Twitter at Josh Malina, MALINA.
Anything? Thank you. Thank you for spelling it.
Well, I feel like I know you intimately, Josh.
I feel the same way about you, Matt.
Thank you.
I do love the podcast. I'm excited to be on it.
I'm excited to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I was there. What's in a name? Well, if you take my name, Matthew, that's the Hebrew for gift of God, ladies. And if you take Gourley, it's probably just some old Irish for people who made their wives out of peat moss. Ladies again. Moss ladies. But I love a good name. And I love it when any writer of a book or movie or play gives their characters some sort of interesting and original name.
And two of my favorites are the films Bad News Bears and Dr. Strangelove. And I think we might do kind of a versus here to see which has the best names. It's not easy to come up with original names, but these two films have something in common. The names are evocative of, in this case, gross things, usually. And they're going for a little bit of feeling, and definitely in the case of Dr. Strangelove, a sexual theme. So I'm going to take you through some of the characters' names, and the... There's my cat. It's early in the morning, and if I'm sounding a little quiet, I can't talk when the cat's going. There are two things that shouldn't be done before 12 in the morning, and that is podcasting and drinking, and I'm doing all three. Two. What? Let's start with the Bad News Bears. Right off the bat, your main character is named Coach Morris Buttermaker. That's not a real name. It probably is. Actually, you know what? Even Goldfinger's a real name. But it just sounds slightly heightened and gross, but also delicious. Kind of like Walter Matthau himself, I think. And I mean that in the best way. Buttermaker. Just say it. Morris Buttermaker. Buttermaker. Say it out loud. Doesn't matter where you are. And then look at anybody that looks at you funny and stare them down till they look away. Buttermaker. But getting to the characters that have a little bit of, let's say, body functionality, you've got Kelly Leak, played by Jackie Earl Haley, but not spelled like the vegetable. Leak is spelled like the actual bodily function, or dam function, if you want to keep it non-gross. But I would argue that's just the beginning of a theme, because there's also Tanner Boyle and Timmy Lupus, and there's no way to argue lupus isn't referring to a blood disease, I think. Other characters are just fun to say, like Amanda Wurlitzer and Ogilvy and Engelberg. And then there's, of course, the lawyer who gets the team started in the first place, who couldn't be more suburban and Caucasian, and his name is Bob Whitewood. But as much as I love the names in Bad News Bears, I think this is really just a setup for probably the victor in this versus round of character names, and that's Dr. Strangelove. And namely, its titular character, Dr. Strangelove. Titular. Doesn't that sound dirty? Well, get ready, because that's just the tip of the titberg. Huh? The name Dr. Strangelove itself is strange and includes love. And it's really just a setup for all of these other names that are going to be strange and probably have something to do with love or sex. Let's go down this list. First of all, Peter Sellers plays three different characters in the film. Dr. Strangelove, President Merkin Muffley, which, if you dissect that, really has two wonderfully licentious names. Merkin, of course, is a wig, but not for your head. And Muffley is what that wig would become. Look, we're all adults here. We don't need to get all embarrassed. He also plays Group Captain Lionel Mandrake. Now, that one sounds all right on the surface, but the Mandrake root was an aphrodisiac back in the Renaissance. In fact, there's even a Commedia dell'arte play called The Mandrake, which is all about getting people all ready to go, all turned on and turgid. Turgid? You mean General Buck Turgidson, played by George C. Scott? That's right. Boner name. It's almost as if the film goes on, the names get more and more ridiculous and obvious, so you're starting with something a little bit more subtle like Mandrake, but then when you get to Sterling Hayden's part, it's Brigadier General Jack D. Ripper. Jack D. Ripper. So that implies the gross sexual murderer, but also Ripper itself has a bit of a bodily function feel, if you know where I'm going. And where I'm going is just that way, because Keenan Wynn plays Colonel Bat Guano. Batshit. Crazy. This whole film is a wealth of amazing character names. Some of them aren't as on the nose, but they're still fun to say, like Slim Pickens' Major Kong, James Earl Jones in his first film appearance as Lieutenant Lothar Zog, and there's even a Mr. Staines and General Faceman. And if it weren't enough, all of this action climaxes, no pun intended, in a location called Burpleson Air Force Base. Stanley Kubrick. Ah, oh, there's that liquid you again. I think it probably is Kubrick, but I feel too pretentious saying it like that. So bear with me if I just say Kubrick. It's the same with Max von Sydow. That sounds too fancy. Anyway, Kubrick originally intended Dr. Strangelove, based off the 1962 novel Red Alert, to be a serious drama. But the more he dove into it, the more he saw how ridiculous the concept of mutually assured destruction was and decided to turn it into a comedy. And then he decided to have a little fun with the names, as we did here today.
I was there.
Well, that's it for I Was There Too. My thanks to Joshua Molina. If you have someone you can connect me to, give me an email call at iwasthere2pod@gmail.com. Leave a review and all that stuff, and see you next time on I Was There Too.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.